So, good evening, everyone. And does anyone have any questions or comments before we start? Questions about the practice? Yes.
The difference between consciousness and awareness.
The difference between consciousness and awareness. I don't know. But why do you ask the question?
Well, because I feel that the consciousness, awareness is bigger than consciousness.
Uh-huh.
And that awareness is of all, and the feeling and the inside and the outside, and just being aware, experiencing the present, and consciousness has to do with thoughts. So I wanted clarification from your experience.
I think what's important here for me, listening to you, is you defined awareness and consciousness through your own experience, and that's enough for me. If now we want to start arguing about the definitions of what consciousness is and awareness is, we would lose the it's a little bit funny, the sound. Is it a little bit funny to you guys? A little bit funny. I feel kind of like, I don't know, anything we can do? Can we move this? Or is that better? I'm very conscious, self-conscious about the sound. Is that better a little bit? So if we start talking about the definitions of consciousness and mindfulness and awareness, probably different people have different definitions. And then pretty soon we're maybe arguing with each other or the philosophy of it all. And we lose track of what was most important in all this is that you have a particular experience that you put the label awareness on, which is kind of no inside outside, this global, this panoramic, I guess, sense of presence. And consciousness, which is something much more particular, which is the kind of the cognitive or thoughtful kind of recognition of what things are. And so the labels are not as important for me as your experience, and then working with that experience mindfully and finding your way to freedom from that. It doesn't satisfy your curiosity, but Buddhism wasn't meant to satisfy our curiosity. It was meant to help us become free.
Continue to explore.
And it's a little bit hard for me to... Buddhism has technical psychology, which has very clear definitions of something in English we've called consciousness, vijnana, and then exactly what that is, how to translate it into English words. It's not actually so direct. So what is awareness and what is consciousness? What is attention? Or what is mindfulness? I mean, I'm a mindfulness teacher, and I don't really know. You know, there's technical definitions of it, and popular ways of using these kinds of words. And my sense is that they're kind of like sets of cluster of ideas which overlap in meaning. You know, they overlap in functioning of what they are.
I don't really have a question, but into your thoughts. So I followed the directions of the homework in the last class, and sorry, comments afterwards. And I was meditating for like half an hour. And I definitely got to a much deeper level of sort of concentration. I guess it's kind of hard for me to really say that it was, you know, like this focus where it felt like my whole... you know, like almost like a science fiction movie where like all the senses just kind of like, you know, ears flip forward, eyes turn red, just kind of zone in on it. And it seemed to be pretty persistent, you know, like when I meditated, you know, days after that, I was able to sort of find that place. So, you know,
great.
I think it gave me a little bit of perspective, you know, because I had questions earlier about the whole life. What gets better here? How does it change? You know, I think initially it was, you know, I felt like any minute I was going to get recognized as a, you know, reincarnated being or something, yeah. Or something. And now I kind of realize that that's just kind of a work, and there's a lot of it ahead of it, but it's kind of cool. I don't know, I just wanted to say thanks, because I've been meditating for a long time.
Great, great. Great.
I think the key was just really understanding the focus was a real, but that I could sort of control and sort of operate the vehicle to attention.
Uh-huh. Great, that's lovely. The a very common way of a very common synonym for concentration is unification. Because in English, when you think of concentration, we think of it only as kind of a mental focus. And it's certainly one aspect of samadhi, which is the Buddhist word for concentration. But samadhi has a much broader meaning. It means, the etymology of the word means to compose, to be composed on the experience. And it's like all of who we are, all the different facets of us, our cognitive, our emotional, our physical, all converge, all get united in the same direction for the same purpose. So mostly many people find themselves at odds with each other. They're kind of split off, and their body is one place and their mind is somewhere else. And then their intentions are somewhere else, you know. They're thinking about yesterday, their body happens to be here, but that's incidental. and their wish is to go out and get pizza. And so all these different things are operating, you know, and the body's calling for attention, and the memories are calling for attention, and the intention is calling for attention, and so we're split. But when all these different facets are operating together in the same direction, like they're all focusing on the breath, the intention is to be with the breath. In the sense, if you're thinking, thoughts are about the breath, your body is connected to your breathing, your physical sense of breathing, your emotions are somehow completely intertwined or entangled or connected in a wonderful way with the breathing, with the concentration on the breath. Everything's working together. That's called unification. And so the one-pointedness is not just a one-pointedness of the mind, but it's a one-pointedness of our whole being kind of converging on this one particular thing that we're focusing on. So I like the word. I'm very much fond of the fact that concentration can... The word samadhi is... Sam means with. And the deep part means to stand. And it happens to be that the word English word compose, kam means with, and the pose means to stand. So it's one of the best etymological kind of equivalents of samadhi is to be composed. And I like that a lot because for samadhi, because compose is something we do with our whole being, our whole body. You compose yourself in an experience. So rather than concentrating on, you know, some physical pain if you have, or some concentrating on your breath, in a sense, if you compose yourself on the breath, or compose yourself on the strong sensation you have, you bring much more of yourself into it. So a person could be like, have physical pain in the knee, and they're focusing on it, but their belly is kind of like pulling away from it. You know, I don't want to deal with that. Or they're tightening away from it, bracing against it. But to be composed on it, it's like your belly has to be relaxed. We kind of settle into it. The whole being settles into it, as opposed to just kind of making kind of high-pitched mental focus. Does that make sense?
I had just kind of a realization the last time I was meditating. My legs were really bothering me. I guess one was like falling asleep and the other one was getting sore. So I was trying to tell myself, just focus on the breathing, it'll go away. And realizing, no, it doesn't always go away, and realizing that part of why I get mentally uncomfortable with leg pain is because, you know, a few years ago I was really struggling with tendonitis. And if you just ignore it and hope it goes away, kind of, it doesn't, you know. It persists for a week if I don't change something. And so I struggle with the idea, well, just sit and notice it. No, when you have something like that, you have to do something. You have to change your posture or ice it or something. So I kind of feel like, well, here I am trying to focus on my breathing or something else, but I can't just ignore this leg pain because it isn't just going to go away. Or maybe it will, but I have this fear that it won't. Sometimes it's that, yeah, probably will, but I have this fear that it won't because of that experience. Of,
great. Uh-huh.
You know, like lying awake at night, not being able to get to sleep for hours and hours because my arm is throbbing. So
So we often bring our history with us to our present experience, and sometimes our history brings a certain kind of street smarts about something, and sometimes it can be a burden.
Yeah.
The way that mindfulness unfolds is that if you feel some strong physical pain in your body, or anything, any strong sensation, be strong pleasant sensation, and it kind of stronger than the breath, or it's kind of pulling you away from the breath, it keeps insisting on attention. You can just let go of the breath entirely. And you don't have to ignore the pain then. You actually focus on the pain. And in focusing on them, you get a lot of the number of benefits. One benefit is that you hopefully can discern the difference between damaging pain and pain which is not damaging. And if you're not sure, then err on the side of being careful and break the posture. But it's pretty common for meditators, beginning meditators, to have physical pain in their body. And often it's not damaging. But you know, hopefully if you're paying careful attention, you notice a difference between what's damaging and not damaging. The fact that there's physical pain doesn't mean automatically mean you have to change your posture. If it's not damaging, there's a lot of benefits to just bringing careful attention to that pain. One of the things we can start learning is that by paying attention to the pain, we can notice all those secondary arrows we add on top of it, all the reactions, the judgments, the assigning a meaning, and begin simplifying the mental ecology. So those aren't operating so strongly or don't have a script so much. Also, if you can focus on the pain, sometimes the attention to the pain can let the pain move, unravel, dissolve, unfold in ways or teach us things that we couldn't learn if we weren't focused on it. So generally in meditation, we don't teach you to ignore anything. If someone says, you know, I'm just focusing on my breath and ignoring this or that, that's a sign that to wake up, you know, and ignore. The act of ignoring is considered one of the root causes for bad karma.
Well, I guess I don't mean literally ignoring, but to me it's like, well, if my foot is hurting, it's telling me, move it. And so if I don't move it, that's, in a sense, it's like ignoring the child saying, do this. And of course, you are literally hearing the child and choosing not to respond.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by ignoring.
Maybe. But I mean, if you think it's not being damaging, there can be benefits just hanging out there with the pain. And if you get discouraged because it's difficult to stay with pain, then you should certainly change your posture. But if every time we feel uncomfortable, feel some pain in meditation, we adjust the posture, then we're going to lose a tremendous benefit from the meditation, which comes with finding freedom and ease and peace with difficulties as they are, as opposed to needing our peace and happiness to come when the difficulties have gone away. You see, many of us think that happiness and peace come from just setting all the conditions just right in our life, and so we're always negotiating, trying to manipulate and fix life. But part of the secret of meditation is that you don't have to change anything. You don't have to have comfort in your body. You don't have to have, you know, perfect all kinds of conditions. It's an inner kind of aspect of the mind to find that equanimity, that peace, that happiness that can be there even in spite of great difficulties in one life. So, for example, I find this very helpful. My own training in meditation, I've sat with a lot of, you know, kind of in a voluntary way, I've sat with a lot of difficulty in meditation, pain and stuff like that. And I found a lot of benefit from it. And some of that benefit I see very clearly now that I have this 3-month-old at home. And sometimes he cries inconsolable. You know, we try everything we can do to make him feel better. And it's very painful to have this baby cry, you know, turn red in the face and shake. And it's a very, very uncomfortable, you know, thing. But because I know myself well enough, I watch my reactions, I see what I'm doing, and I know how to stay calm in the midst of that, usually. I think because of that training that I've learned how to be with difficulties in my meditation. So I find that it translates into situations in life where you can't fix it. You know, we try everything I can to fix this 3-month-old, but nothing seems to be working. So do I then continue getting more and more anxious? Doesn't make any sense. Probably not helpful for him. So the meditation training then helps me to keep calm and peaceful, anxiety-free at least. So part of the advantage of not avoiding difficulty in meditation is it's kind of a training in how to be peaceful with all things as they are. And there might come a time in your life where you have strong physical pain that doesn't go away. You know, there are people for whom a medication doesn't work, and or maybe you're far away from any kind of medication. I remember once, many years ago now, but I was up in the city late, and I was coming down 101, and I had a splitting headache. And I had it filled with, you know, and there was no aspirin nearby. I guess I could have gone off the freeway and done something, taken a nap, or, but it was like 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and so I wasn't going to do that. And I could have gone someplace and got an aspirin, but I just wanted to get home. And I had this splitting headache. And I was filled with self-pity. Oh, poor Gil. Until I remembered, you know, that I have this mindfulness practice. I teach it. And I said, okay. So then I started paying attention. And as soon as I started paying attention, careful attention to the pain and what was going on inside, I got peaceful very quickly. But once I got, the pain didn't go away, but I got very peaceful because I had that skill. I trained myself. I learned how to do that. But once, then I got complacent. And after a while, I was reading the billboards again, or you're doing something else, you know, and my attention slipped away from what was actually going on for me. And then the self-pity crept back in. As long as I stayed attentive, I could stay peaceful and happy, even with a pain. But if I stopped paying attention, then the pain would take over again, and all these unhealthy forms of suffering would follow in its wake. So hopefully that made sense. So the odd thing about meditation, I mean, many spiritual traditions say this. They say, it's not just Buddhists who say it. I think Plato said it, and the Sufi poet Rumi said this. Many people said that if you run away from your suffering, it chases after you. But if you go towards it, then it can dissolve, or you can resolve it. Many people want to, you know, there was a famous poem by Rumi where he says, talks about life's reversals. Those who go for the cool water, dive into the cool water, find their heads popping up into the fire. And those who dive into the fire find their heads popping up in the cool water. So there's this spiritual teaching, or common sense, that some things are better gone into and explored and resolved and dealt with than they are ignoring them and trying to go away and finding some kind of alternative. So we're not encouraging people in mindfulness practice to suffer. It can sound like that, doesn't it? But what we're encouraging people to do is to be willing to stay present and mindful for what is happening in their life at any given moment. So if it's great pleasure and joy, stay present for that. There are some people who check out when there's a lot of joy. And if there's suffering or difficulties in life, stay present there too. Just stay present with whatever's going on. And the meditation practice is a training to do that. So what I was going to say last week was that so Buddhism started in India, and they had different kind of Sanskrit words that they used. And when Buddhism traveled to China, they had to translate those words not only into Chinese, but also the Chinese pictographs, the characters, which sometimes tell a story. And so it's interesting, the two main elements of meditation practice are concentration and mindfulness. And they translated those two words by the Chinese characters for stop and look. It's so basic and kind of earth, you know, down to earth kind of thing, you know, just stop and look. That's what concentration and mindfulness means. You stop and you look. So a lot of the function of concentration is somehow stop, so you can really notice and see what is actually going on. So when we sit down to meditate, we stop all our usual everyday activities and sit down and close our eyes. It's kind of a stopping. And then we see clearly what's going on. Or we stop all the regular kind of directions that the mind goes, all the distracted thoughts and obsessions of the mind. We stop that and look carefully at the breath. We stop that in order to see clearly, more clearly, what's really going on with us under the surface of our chatter. So the idea of stopping and looking. And sometimes in meditation, the stopping part is emphasized more. Oh, I'll let go of those thoughts. I'll sit still. I'll let go of that attachment. I'll stop that, if that's available. But sometimes we can't let go. We can't stop. And then the other half comes into play, where we look, what's happening here? And in all circumstances, we can usually do one or the other. In some circumstances, it makes sense to do more stopping. In some circumstances, it makes more sense to stop and look. If you have a lot of busy chatter in your mind, it simply doesn't want to stop when you meditate. Then you need to look at thinking. You need to do thinking meditation. Look at that chatter. Look at the emotions connected to it. Look at the energetics of it, like we talked about last week. You have trouble hearing?
A little bit.
Little bit. If you sit over here, I think you're closer to the speaker. That might help. Because I don't know if I can speak any louder. Because we have you okay? So stopping and looking. So you can always look. So I say all this because some meditators are ready to judge their meditation negatively pretty quickly. Oh, it's not going right. It's supposed to be different. It's supposed to be calmer, more concentrated or something. But we're not asked to kind of have a more concentrated or calmer experience necessarily. That's helpful if that happens. But the practice works if we're simply seeing what's happening right now. If you can see what's happening now, that's the meditation practice. And don't judge yourself negatively because you haven't gotten into a concentrated state. Does that make sense? So I said something. The two words are translated as stop and look. Are the Sanskrit words samatha vipassana. Samatha is concentration, and vipassana means insight, which is what we practice here. The word for mindfulness, which is the basis for having insight, was translated into Chinese by a very nice character that has two halves. The top half is made up of the character for a roof of a house. And then underneath there, the character for the present moment. That's the top half. And the bottom half is the character for a heart. The heart in the present moment. Or being at home in the heart. Or the heart in the home. A heartfulness. So part of being mindfulness is to bring a heartfelt quality to the attention of what you're noticing in the present moment. So it has a sense of goodwill or heartfeltness or friendliness. Or kindness to what your experience is. That's not always possible because of, you know, our mood or whatever. But if the goal is to see if we can evoke a friendly, heartfelt relationship to what our experience is, a heartfeltness in doing the meditation practice. So the meditation practice is not just simply something cognitive, something we're doing with our mind and our awareness. It's not just a technical thing we're doing, but it's something we're putting our hearts into. You know, we enter into it with our full being. So again, the idea of unification. We bring our whole being into this experience. We don't hold any of ourselves back. And many people have the experiences they hold themselves back from life. And so the meditation practice, in a sense, is a training how not to hold back anymore and how to let ourselves experience the fullness of life through the fullness of our being, who we are. So let's start now with our sitting. And so make yourselves comfortable enough in an alert posture. Gently close your eyes. And as I've talked about earlier, there are various setup techniques for getting settled in meditation, like breathing deeply and relaxing the body. But in order to do mindfulness practice, you don't have to do any setup. You can simply notice how you are right now, what's happening now. You can ease your way into the practice by breathing deeply for a while or relaxing the body. Or you can plunge in by simply immediately noticing what is happening now. What is your experience of your body right now? What is your experience of feelings and emotions? And what is your experience of your mind, your thoughts, your thinking? Simply to notice. What's your experience of breathing? It's not always so easy to be in the present moment. So in the beginning of a meditation session, it's useful to remind yourself that you're reining the mind into the present. You're settling in, you're coming into the present, returning here, coming to inhabit your body in the present moment. That it's your present moment experience which is your lived experience. All your thoughts about future, past, conversations, fantasies, in comparison, are kind of a virtual reality. It's in the present you'll find your precious lived experience. So we begin by feeling your breathing, the living experience of breathing in and breathing out. Feeling the rhythm of breathing in and breathing out, breathing in and breathing out. when the mind wanders away from the breath. Acknowledge the fact that you're thinking. Relax the thinking mind. Begin again with the breathing. Composing yourself on the breathing. So it's not just watching the breath with your mind. It's also experiencing the breathing through the whole body, with the body. As you exhale, letting go of your thoughts. If there's a pause at the end of the exhalation, rest there. Don't hold on to it. Just rest there quietly until the next in-breath starts on its own. as you experience each in-breath and out-breath, let the breathing calm you. Let it quiet and settle the mind, the body. Quieting the mind from all its concerns and thoughts. Helping you to be composed at home in your body here and now. And if something other than the breath becomes compelling, body sensations, sounds, feelings, thinking, see if you can be aware of those things in a composed way, peacefully aware of the body or feelings or thoughts. Being careful not to get swept up into the commentary and thinking and thoughts about these experiences. But if you want to get swept up by anything, get swept up by the immediacy, the lived experience, the feeling, the sensations, the felt sense. Being relaxed with how things are. Remembering that mindfulness involves clearly noticing, recognizing how it is right now. Not chasing after some ideal, but rather recognizing, accepting, being with how things actually are. And in that acceptance and recognition, then beginning to settle and concentrate with how things are. What is it that has to be accepted right now so you can be more fully present with how things are? getting into the rhythm of your breathing. So you can hang in there with from one breath to the other. The quieter you become, the more clearly you can be aware of the commentary and the thoughts and the story making that gets in the way. The belief systems. When there's no stories that you tell yourself, no commentary, no ideals you're living up to, or it can be very simple to be at peace and at ease in the present moment. We need so little. So in its simplest version, mindfulness meditation simply means paying attention to what's happening in the present moment. There are all kinds of meditation, different kinds of meditation practices out there, and some of them don't entail particularly paying attention to what's going on. There are, for example, visualization practices or mantra practices where you focus on a mantra. This particular meditation practice uses your present moment experience as the gateway of deeper spiritual experiences. So in simplicity, it simply means paying attention to what's happening in the present moment. But because the mind is so flighty, because it's so easy to get lost in the mind, the commentary, the thoughts of the mind, we put a lot of emphasis on using the breathing as a place to stabilize the mind, to help us pull us into the present moment, be the anchor to the present moment. We tend to use the breath as a way, place to develop concentration on the breath, concentration, being with the breath, concentrating on the breath. Because the more concentrated you can become, the more clearly your mindfulness can function, the more clearly you can see. As with great concentration, look, you can see some of the subtleties of what goes on in your experience, the subtlety of what goes on in the mind, the subtlety that goes on in your physical experiences, the subtlety of what it's like to be a human being. That's really invisible when the mind is kind of regular street consciousness, where you're kind of busy and thinking and chattering and all this, the mind has to be very still in order to seek very precisely what's actually going on here. So the tendency is in Buddhism is to try to bring these two elements together in harmony, both working very strongly, the element of concentration and the element of mindfulness practice. So in its simplicity, mindfulness practice simply means to pay attention. And you can do that. And some teachers only emphasize mindfulness. Pay attention to what's going on. Pay attention to your feelings, your thoughts, your physical experiences, the sounds, the sights. Just pay attention to what's happening. Be mindful. And you can go very far just by doing that. Some teachers emphasize, before you do mindfulness meditation, you spend a lot of time doing concentration meditation, that you're only developing concentration. And then you switch over to do mindfulness once you have that strong mind, the concentrated mind. And some teachers emphasize kind of doing both at the same time, developing the two in tandem. I think that's kind of how we teach here. So we're focusing on the breath, which is a concentration place, but also using it for mindfulness to recognize and see the breath for what it is, be with the breath, be ready to leave the breath if something else becomes more compelling. Learning how to be at peace and not caught up in the commentary with whatever is going on. If a person wants to develop the practice further from this basic introductory course, there's a number of ways to do that. One way is to have a daily meditation practice. I probably can't underscore enough how incredibly valuable it is to have a daily meditation practice. Some people will go on retreats and love retreats and not do much meditation practice at home. But I think for long-term stability, to have the kind of changes that happen through meditation really take root in a deep way, it really helps to do to have this daily, ongoing sitting meditation practice. It's kind of like, I love the little expression with the Buddha said, with dripping drops of water, the water jug is filled. With dripping drops of water, the bathtub is filled. Little drops. And they accumulate slowly over time. You might not see much change from day to day when you do daily sitting meditation. But over the months, you might start seeing changes, either in meditation itself or in your daily life. And maybe I said this last week, I don't remember. But if you sit regularly on a daily basis, or almost daily basis, when I first started meditation practice, I had been introduced to Zen meditation at the San Francisco Zen Center. And they had a meditation schedule there where they meditated every day except Sunday. So I thought that's the way you did it. So I did daily meditation twice a day for about 2 years before I went to live at Zen Center. But I didn't meditate on Sunday. That worked great. It was kind of nice. So, but anyway, daily meditation practice. So if you do that for 6 months, then a week or 2 weeks, then you might really see the difference. You might see the great benefit it's provided you. When you stop and you realize you get a little bit more agitated easily or busy in your thoughts or anxious or whatever it might be. So sitting every day is very helpful. The other thing that's very helpful is applying these basic principles of mindfulness into our daily life outside of meditation practice. And some people love to do this part of the practice. And some people feel it's very important to do it because if it's just about meditation practice, then it's kind of disconnected from the rest of your life. And in fact, the line between the mind in meditation and the mind outside of meditation is an arbitrary line. It's all life. And it's natural, I think, as people do the meditation practice, after a while, become interested in how to apply it or live that way in daily life. The way I worded it for myself when I was early meditator was I experienced a kind of integrity, personal integrity when I sat and meditated that I didn't have in daily life. And then I became interested after a while, how could I live this integrity in my daily life also? So then the question was, how do I apply this mindfulness and presence and stability and calm into my daily life. So part of that comes from just applying these principles, training yourself in daily life to pay attention to what's happening right now. It's so easy not to pay attention. So for example, a story I told of having a headache. I knew I had a headache, I was miserable, but I also wasn't paying attention to it really. If someone asked me, you have a headache, I would say, of course I have a headache, I'm aware of it. But I wasn't really paying attention to it. I was basically trying to, you know, in being reactive mode towards it. I was reactive to it and had enough attention to be reactive to it, but I wasn't really being attentive to it. Or we're lost in our fantasies or planning the future. It's all kinds of ways in which we're not really paying attention to what's actually happening now. It's so valuable to stop and pay attention to what's happening now in all kinds of areas of life. It doesn't have to be physically stopping. It just means that you kind of pause mentally for a moment to notice what's happening in this moment, what's happening here. And then all these different areas to pay attention to can come into play according to what's appropriate. Sometimes it's very valuable to pay attention to your physical body. Sometimes it's valuable to pay attention to your emotions carefully. Sometimes it's valuable to pay attention to your thoughts, your beliefs, your cognitive movements of your mind. And so as you pay attention to the present moment, in different situations, you pay attention to these different aspects of your experience. And you can be fluid, moving around between your body and your emotions, your thoughts, and just learning to massage your experience by learning to pay attention to different aspects of it. Learning to notice carefully the reactivity we have to the present moment experiences, the commentary we have about it, noticing how the reactivity and the commentary are different than the actual experience. Are they optional? Are they inherently necessary? What's your relationship to your reactive mode that you have in the present moment? Can you not be so reactive? Can you notice your reactivity but not act on it? Oh, look at that. Isn't that amazing? I was furious at my friend, but I didn't say anything. That's new. Or whatever it might be. So beginning to apply these things, paying attention to the present moment in daily life. And for this purpose, some people like to have to do it in small increments. Like some people will take a 20-minute period of time in daily life. Maybe could be any 20-minute time every day, 20 minutes outside of meditation, where they do their normal activities, but they try to do it in a way that they're mindful of what's happening, bring their mind back to the present moment whenever it wanders off. And you'll be surprised how often it wanders off, just like in meditation practice. Some people like to do it at particular times, like when they're walking from their car, if this is their case, where they park it going to work, and walking to their office or their store or wherever they go to go. Some people like to do it different times of day, over the weeks, you know, in the morning or afternoon or evening or different times, different activities. Sometimes it's nice for a week to do one particular activity, like maybe cooking breakfast. Those minutes, just be really mindful of it. And take it that for a week. And then the next week do, you know, doing your toiletries in the morning for a few weeks or something a week. And then do something else for a week. And take some different aspects of your life. And slowly over the months and years, you're beginning to bring a different kind of mindfulness and presence to the different activities you do. And you might even adjust your activities and how you do them because you find it's much more satisfying to do them in a mindful way. Or you find by paying attention to them, you do them in ways which are stressful or not so useful, healthy for you. And you only see that by really, really being honest and being present for how things actually are. Some people like to have mindfulness cues. And there's all kinds of cues you can use. Some people, I like to use a telephone sometimes. And when the telephone rings, I won't answer it right away, but let it ring for a few times. And when it's ringing, I'm not trying to, I stop and just be with my breath for a while, just check in with myself, be mindful of what's happening. That's a good thing to do before you answer the phone. For a long time, I used door frames as mindfulness cues. Whenever I walk through a door frame into a different area, like outside or inside or different room, you're going into a different space in a sense. It makes sense to pay attention. So I'd use a door frame as a reminder to pay attention to what's happening now, as opposed to just continuing to be lost in my story and whatever I was doing. I've known people who've taken little little dots or something, or stars, and put them on different things in their homes, like put them on the light switches and telephones or refrigerator doors or doorknobs or you know different things they're going to encounter during the day. And every time you see those little stickers, you say, oh, pay attention to the present moment. What's happening right now? What's happening right now? Allison tried, I don't know if you ever got it together, Allison had this idea of a mindfulness bell, like a watch, like a wristwatch or a little device, right, that would randomly go off during the day. Ding dong. And that'll be your sign to pay attention.
Does the CD, I realize, can be used as a bell of mindfulness?
Oh, her CD. You just plug your CD in.
And put it in repeat mode.
Oh, in repeat mode.
And then scramble repeat mode.
Uh-huh. I love it.
So you can do a variable time interval, or you can do it at a fixed time interval. So you can choose a smaller time interval, but you can't do it with the randomness.
I love it. That's great. When I was in the monastery, we would have this sometimes this thing where, like when I was in the kitchen, we had a whole big kitchen crew. Anybody had permission, if they felt there was a need in the kitchen, to go over and ring the bell that was on the kind of little altar. And that was a mindfulness bell. Everything had to stop for a moment while the ringing finished, and ding, ding, breathe. And the kitchen was often a hot spot, so that was often used sometimes to get people to pay attention, to settle down. And for a while, for some time, in situations far away from anybody else, or anybody else could hear it, I used the beeper on my watch for that purpose. It would go off every 30 minutes. And it was it's fascinating to do something like this, because you think you're paying attention, until you hear this mindfulness bell, and you just, oh, then you really realize, oh, I wasn't even there. Even in meditation, it's good to have mindfulness bell, like every 5 minutes, right? Because, you know, and people can fool themselves and think they're much more present than they actually are. And only by having some little cue like that can, oh, boy, I was in Tahiti. So applying the practice in daily life is very helpful. Being interested in that, learning how to be embodied and composed in our experience as we do it. The other way of developing the practice and developing further concentration, bringing the concentration in together with the mindfulness, is to go on retreats. And this is an ancient custom in Buddhism, to go on retreats. And we offer all kinds of retreats here at IMC. There's half-day retreats and one-day retreats, and we offer up in the mountains here weekend retreat once a year and longer retreats. Spirit Rock offers retreats. Other Buddhist groups offer retreats. But to be able to go off for some period of time, whether it's a weekend or 10 days or some period, these retreats are usually done in silence. And there's not a lot of activity to be done except to meditate. They give you nice food usually. And there might be a simple chore everybody does to help make the retreat run smoothly. But it's an ideal environment to be undistracted by life around you. Because many of us are distracted by the activities of our lives, and television and media and jobs and cleaning and cooking and shopping and conversations and all these things that we're doing all the time. But to stop, you know, stop and look, to stop all these normal daily activities, including speech, so we can see clearly what our life is really all about, is very, very powerful. As you know, there's like vision quests. People go 40 days in the deserts. It's kind of similar ideas. Buddhists go on retreat. We get 3 meals a day usually. And it's a really beautiful thing to do. But in either case, whether it's developing the mindfulness practice further through daily life practice or sitting every day, or whether it's going on retreat, we want to try to develop a kind of attention to our life. We begin cutting through the commentary, the story-making capacity of the mind. So we don't believe necessarily all the story. We tell ourselves of what we need and who we are, or we cut through all the commentary, all the concepts we have that keep us removed from how things actually are. And one of the very important principles or goals of mindfulness practice is to help us distinguish between the interpretation we have of reality and more directly how reality actually is. Most of our life is mediated through concepts. The classic one some teachers like to point to is the Big Dipper. You look in the sky and everybody can see a Big Dipper kind of up there. But there's no Big Dipper up there at all. You know, it's just these stars that happen to be, you know, they're not even lined up. If once you get, you know, different perspective, they don't look like a dipper at all. Just from our perspective, you can kind of line them up and see a dipper, but there's no dipper up there. But once you've been told there's a Big Dipper up there, you can't help but seeing it up there. We overlay the dipper with the stars with that concept. You know, if you go out to the beach one day, if you go out to the beach someday and look at the sunset, and look, oh, the sunset as the sun is settling down into the, over the ocean, right? It's settling down, right? What's really happening is you're standing there hurling back through space at 24,000 miles an hour, you know, spinning backwards. That's what, you know, the sun isn't going down, the earth is spinning backwards, and you're, that's what's really going on, right? And we say it's the sun is setting, but really you're spinning backwards. What's the truth? You know, we often live in interpretations of things rather than how things actually are. So this becomes very important when it comes to concepts of self. And to give you a kind of an analogy towards this direction, I have this very simple exercise I like doing. It's very, there's a famous Zen story of the Buddha holding up a flower. So I'm holding up a flower. And so what's the big deal? It's a flower. You see the flower for what it is. And right now it's just a flower, right? But what's very interesting is when I bring up another flower and put it next to it. So now we can say something we couldn't say before. Now I can say that this is the big flower and this is the small flower. But is bigness and smallness inherent in this? It's not. Bigness and smallness belongs to the comparative mind that's comparing these two things. It's not inherent in the flower of this flower by itself. Because I can do an amazing magic right in front of your eyes, and it's not even any sleight of hand. You see, this is the big flower, this is the small flower. This is the small flower, and this is the big flower. Isn't that amazing? I have made what was big before small. Magic. But you can, when you have concepts like this, comparative concepts, you can play with them. They're arbitrary. The same thing, so many of the concepts of ourselves that we suffer so deeply about. We have all these, a lot of the problematic ideas of who we are and what we need come from comparative forms of thinking. Concepts and ideas we overlay onto the suchness of who we actually are. The suchness of this flower is just a flower by itself. The suchness of the flower is not disturbed by putting this next to it. Though the mind can say, oh, now it's a small flower. But the suchness of the flower doesn't change one bit. So what are we comparing ourselves to? If I tell you that I'm a terrible basketball player, then you can certainly offer your condolences and, you know, and sympathy and wish me well and, you know, offer to take me to the basketball court and give me some, you know, pointers. And you can do all these things, right? Participate in it. Or you can ask, compare, you can say, you're a bad basketball player compared to who? And if I say, well, you know, compared to Michael Jordan, then, you know, you probably think, you know, you know, that, you know, you probably don't take me so seriously. But if I say, you know, compared to this, the, you know, this 8-year-old who lives down the street from me. You know, we play with concepts. You know, who we compare ourselves to. I'm a good or bad basketball player depending on who I compare myself to. Compared to the 8-year-old, I'm really good. Compared to Michael Jordan, I'm not. So where does this, how does this apply to our lives? For example, our bodies. Many people suffer about something to do with their bodies. It's too tall, it's too short, the hair is not enough hair, it's too much hair, their nose is too big, it's too small, different things, you know, all kinds of things we do. But those are all belong to comparative world of thinking. The nose, whether it's big or small, couldn't care less. The suchness of the nose is just happy by itself. But then we overlay it with our thoughts, the nose this, the nose that, that come to other people. And then, you know, and then that's arbitrary, right? To some degree. We suffer a lot because of the ideas we overlay on top of our immediate experience. So part of the function of mindfulness practice is to begin getting underneath that or teasing it apart so we can see what's an interpretation and what is actually the direct experience. Because the interpretation always involves, in relative degrees, agitating the mind. as we learn to stop living in the concepts and the interpretations, the mind can actually get a lot calmer and quieter. Partly because the ideas themselves don't elicit reactivity, and partly because the interpretations themselves are a kind of reactive mode to be in. So can you just be content and happy in your own suchness, as you are, without comparing yourself to who you were in the past, without comparing yourself to who you might want to be in the future, without comparing yourself to some ideal of shoulds or who you should be or who you shouldn't be, without comparing yourself to your neighbors or friends or anybody else? If you do away with all that kind of comparative thinking, who are you? What are you left with? And probably most people would feel so much more happy and at ease with themselves if they stop that kind of comparative thinking. That kind of comparative thinking is not inherently necessary in being a human being. So part of the function of this meditation practice is to learn to stop living in that world of interpretation. In order to do that, we have to be able to see the difference between the direct experience and the interpretation. So you're sitting here meditating, and you have a hard time being with your breath, you know, because you can't see, cannot, and then you interpret that meaning, I'm a lousy meditator. How does that make you feel to say, I'm a lousy meditator? Probably you feel a little bit depressed. You're telling yourself stories about what kind of meditator you are. You don't have to do that. It's enough simply to recognize, oh, at this particular sitting, the mind is not very concentrated. That's true enough experience. But then to interpret that meaning, oh, this means I'm a lousy meditator, that's telling yourself a story. Which is easier? Which is more pleasant? To be someone whose concentration is poor at that particular moment, or to be someone who's a lousy meditator? The suchness of not having concentration can be as relaxing and as easeful as anything else. So there's the whole world of meditation is fascinating. And I know some people who don't meditate think, oh, meditation is pretty boring. I mean, life is offers so much variety and variation. As you go into the inner life, the life of the mind, the heart, the spirit, that inner world is amazingly varied. And it's a microcosm of all of life that offers tremendous adventure and wisdom and understanding and love and compassion and peace, beautiful aspects of our lives. And I would suggest that once you kind of get a hang of how to be present, how to be mindful, how to be a little bit concentrated, you probably never get bored in meditation, or very seldom. It'll open up in all kinds of interesting areas for you and help your life immensely. It helps in having a regular meditation practice to sit periodically with other people. There's a lot of benefit that comes from sitting in meditation groups. We kind of learn by osmosis. It's nice to have the support and nice to have teachings from other people. You're all welcome to come here. Our membership policy here is that anybody who comes is a member, or if you don't want to come, anybody who wants to consider themselves a member is a member. Anybody, you know, everybody, you know, is very welcome to be part of here. But there's other groups all over. There's Zen groups, and here in Redwood City there's a wonderful little group, and Zen group, and in Mountain View there's one, and there's Vipassana sitting group like this small one in San Jose, and you know, there's different meditation groups around. There's other non-Buddhist groups you can sit with. Find one that's compatible for you. But it's very helpful to sit with other people. If you want to come here to our center, there is a newsletter that has all our different programs. And again, we run this place rather informally. Not because we're casual people, but partly because I think that there's something very profound and very deep about something which is formless, informal, without form. And we have to find our own way. It's also it tends to be much more welcoming to people because there isn't some form that kind of is an obstacle for people to come in. But you're welcome to come and practice here with us. And we have all kinds of things. We have the Sunday morning sitting and talk. We have Monday sitting and talk. For the next Thursdays, I don't know if it's starting this Thursday. I think it's this Thursday it starts. Richard Shankman's going to give a class on the five hindrances, a five-week class on the five hindrances. And when I do this introductory course, sometimes I do it 6 weeks rather than 5 weeks. And then I add in one day on the five hindrances. They're a very important element for beginning meditators. So if you want to follow up kind of like the 101, 102, you might want to think of taking Richard's course tomorrow evening.
Is the meditation still at the same time?
On Thursday?
Yeah,
it's at 7 o'clock. No, 7:30. 7:30, yeah.
A different format.
A little bit different. A little different format.
Right.
But he'll do sitting. It won't be that different, I think. We'll see. He hasn't told me what he's doing.
No, I mean, it starts with a half-hour sitting right at the very beginning. There's not a class kind of discussion.
Oh, yes. Oh, compared to the format here tonight. Yeah, I'm not sure how he's going to do it, but probably, usually on Thursday evenings, we start with a half-an-hour sitting. And usually there's a very short guided meditation at the beginning. And then there's a lot more informal discussion and stuff afterwards.
What are the hindrances?
The five hindrances are the five obstacles to being present. And so it's really helpful if you want to learn how to be present. If you want to learn to be present, it really helps if you can really become a connoisseur, an expert of recognizing these, even when they're beginning to show their heads. These are desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, agitation and restlessness, and doubt. Doubt. And these are just like universal. This is kind of like this is kind of like the stuff that meditators are often dealing with, because this is what makes it difficult to be present. So to learn how to work with those and how to compost them into further mindful and help them to be more mindful is a lot of what we try to do here. So, yes?
You talk a bit about the formlessness nature of this place a few minutes ago. I was wondering if that was why. Was it intentional to keep the walls very plain?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it was intentional. We might add a little bit. We've added a couple of things here and there. We added a statue a few weeks ago, and we added a word here on the walls here. Have you noticed the word that's on the wall here? Yeah. And but it's kind of like it was meant to be so almost so you couldn't even notice it, because we didn't want it to pull people's attention. And it was actually it was meant for the Dharma teacher, not for the people who come, because that's across from the seat.
Is that why I only noticed it recently?
And it was done this last summer. It's Amata Dhatu, and it's a synonym for Nirvana, and it means the deathless dimension. And it's a reminder for those people who sit here that when you teach Buddhism, all Dharma teachings, just like all the different streams in the mountains, flow down and combine, connect into the big rivers, and end up in the ocean. So all the streams of the Dharma teachings come together and end up in the great ocean of what's called Nirvana, or the deathless dimension. So Dharma teacher, not to lose track, that's where we're going. Yes?
You were talking about interpretation also a few minutes ago. I wanted to hear your comments a little bit about the sources of those interpretations.
Sources of Buddhist interpretations?
Well, the interpretations we apply to our experiences.
Did I answer your first question adequately? I did? Because I kind of felt like I went off.
No,
okay. This particular meditation tradition comes from Southeast Asia.
No, that's not really my question.
Okay.
You're talking about when we, our experience in life, how we kind of filter things really, and interpret experiences, and we want us to get back to the suchness of it. I'm intrigued about where these interpretations are coming from in all this. What creates these interpretations? What creates these filters or whatever?
What creates our interpretations of who we are, comparing ourselves to self and others?
I mean,
there's some obvious answers. In some situations, it can be our fear, it can be our desires, it can be our aversion, it can be our confusion. So in some situations, you can see that it has certain sources that causes us to interpret. But the mind is kind of a meaning-making machine. That's what the mind does.
It's just the nature of the mind.
Well, I'm not a philosopher that way. I don't you know, do I come up with some philosophical root, you know, reason or explanation of how the mind works, hasn't been a big interest of mine. But my impression is that the mind is a meaning-making machine. It's adept at doing it. And sometimes it makes accurate meaning, and sometimes it makes inaccurate meaning. Probably evolutionarily, assigning meaning helps survival of the, you know, people. So there's probably a good reason why we assign meaning. But meaning gets out of hand, and then in the modern world we assign meaning, you know, in more and more abstract and complicated ways that cause all kinds of suffering compared to, you know, it used to be you saw a track and that meant there was an animal further up. And now, you know, we see a track and then it means, oh, I'm a bad tracker because it's been 20 years since I've, you know, been looking for that track and I finally found a track and now I got to show my friends, you know, that I found a track and hopefully they'll understand what a great tracker I am. And, you know, it gets more and more complicated. So why we interpret? The Buddhist version of that question is, which was asked the Buddha, is where does this desire come from? And the Buddha said, the origin of desire cannot be found. It comes from beginningless time. Buddhists don't believe in a single beginning of time. It's so that beginningless time. I'm not here to satisfy you, but in that way, was that the adequate answer?
It's okay.
You want to? The function of this practice is not necessarily to answer those kinds of interesting questions. There are interesting questions, but rather to be able to see enough, clearly enough, so we no longer suffer. Yes.
Two things. I find it helpful to say like in and out. But doesn't that almost become like a mantra?
It can be, and it's your job to be careful it doesn't.
Okay.
And it becomes a mantra if that's you're primarily focusing on saying those words. But what you're trying to do is only 5% of your effort is in saying those words, those notes, mental notes. 95% of what you're doing is feeling your way or sensing, being present for what the note is describing. So the breath, if you say in, 95% is like really feeling what the in-breath is like. And what will happen, it's very important to know that sometimes the mental noting becomes mechanical or we get lost in it like it's a mantra. And when that does, you have to make it organic again. That's just...
The other thing is, what's the implication if during the sitting and all, I found myself in a state very close to falling asleep?
Maybe you're tired. as people get... I mean, you might be tired. It's one of the... A lot of people in America are sleep deprived. So it's evening, so it's normal to be tired. But sometimes people, as they get calmer and calmer in meditation, if they don't have enough alertness, that calmness will lead them towards more sleep-like states, sometimes dream-like states. And the instruction then is to try to arouse a little bit more alertness.
Try to not give into that.
You certainly not give into it, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Could you say more about ignoring? Ignoring implies knowing and ignoring.
Right. The act of ignoring, the act of turning away so you can't pay attention, is considered, it's said in Buddhism, to create bad karma. It's a bad habit to create. And it causes suffering and problems. Generally, not always. There was an article in the paper last year that spouses who were unsolicitous to their mate who had chronic pain. You see that article? So they surveyed people who had chronic pain, and they found that those who had unsolicited spouses had less pain than those who had solicitous husbands. There was a certain kind of difficulties, like chronic pain. It's actually sometimes more wise not to pay attention to it than just to pay attention to it. So sometimes, you know, but you know, we don't like to say that here because we like to emphasize the value of paying attention. And But there's all kinds of reasons why people ignore. People don't want to notice what's going on because it's embarrassing, it's painful, it's threatening to really notice what's going on. And so people will turn their attention away. I'm not going to look at that. I'm not going to see that. I'm not going to deal with that.
So the belief systems would be under that.
It could be, very much so.
This is a very big subject, this belief system.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. And so, something as simple as this meditation practice, which doesn't require any beliefs, just requires seeing clearly what's going on, is a really good kind of like wedge that gets in there and really begins to pull apart the belief systems that tend to run our lives. And then one of the interesting questions, once you kind of see a belief, is you can ask the question, upon what authority do I believe it? Though I've heard Christian theologians tell Buddhist scholars, once you start asking those questions, it's downhill from there. but Buddhists actually are quite happy about this idea because we see the possibility of freedom when we learn not to be attached to beliefs. But we don't have to necessarily do away with our beliefs, but we don't want to be attached to them. We don't want to be stuck by them or limited by them.
That was helpful. You don't have to believe the thoughts. That was very helpful.
So maybe quick, but one or two, if I can answer quickly. So what does it getting involved mean for you?
Well, for me, the emotions. I don't really feel like I have emotions unless I'm, involved in the story about them.
Ah. Okay. So I'd encourage you to keep looking at this. Maybe get this a little bit different route. These hindrances, like especially the first one, desire and aversion, I call them caffeine of the soul. Because in order to get our psyche kind of revved up and going and excited, some people rely on their emotions to do that. And so desire is one way. You could be really excited and wanting. Or having aversion, just hating things and being angry. And so it keeps us going in a sense. But then, like with caffeine, if you stop taking a substance, there's a withdrawal period, and a person feels kind of out of sorts. But then eventually, we get purified of the caffeine, and then a deeper sense of well-being or sense of aliveness can come into play. Emotions can be the same way. Many of us are depending on reactive emotions for our emotional lives. Once we no longer depending on reactive emotions for our emotions, then there's a whole wellspring of non-reactive emotions that can come up into our being that are quite beautiful. And this is, so for example, there can be joy. Joy does not have to be a reactive emotion. I mean, if you just found out you won the California lottery, that's a reactive emotion because you're reacting to the fact that you got this wonderful thing happen and all the stories you have about how wonderful that's going to be. But if you sit in meditation and nothing particular is happening to you, nothing good is happening to you, and you find that this joy just seems to well up on its own, a sense of well-being, that's what we call an unreactive emotion, just a state that's there. As a person becomes freer of reactive emotions, afflictive emotions, then the tendency is that wholesome emotions, happiness, joy, compassion, love, fills a person more and more, becomes more of a regular visitor in who one is. It's almost as if the reactive emotions are a barrier to allow the deeper wellsprings of healthy emotions to flow through us. But in order to get to that, it takes some time, it takes patience, but it also takes beginning to see very clearly and very honestly how it is for you, and learning how to step out of the reactive mode. And as you do that, there might be a transition time where it's actually kind of rocky, because the person would be so used to negotiating life and orienting themselves to life by the stories and the reactive emotions they have. And so sometimes you might even need a therapist or a teacher to hold your hand for a while as you go through that transition period. And then after a while, something else will begin flowing into that empty space. Does that make sense?
Yeah. How to, keep looking at it.
Yeah. It's worth it, really worthwhile. You think I can answer quickly?
I don't know. But why is it good to meditate with a group?
Oh.
Because I've read that, yeah. And you say that.
Oh, yeah. Not required by any means. But there's a couple of benefits that, these are kind of generic teachings, right? Individual people might find different. But sitting in a group, we learn from other people. We learn by osmosis. We kind of pick up subliminally almost how they're sitting, how they're paying attention, how they care of themselves. We kind of get a sense of what it means to bear oneself in a meditative way. There's also often a kind of that sense of tuning into the other people meditating, a sense of stillness that becomes very palpable and very supportive of our own capacity to be still. Some people report they get much more concentrating sitting in a group ever sitting at home. There's greater intention maybe involved when you sit in a group. Everybody's doing the same thing, and you feel a little more serious and more intent when you're sitting with the group. When you're at home alone, it's easier to kind of wander. Some people find the opposite is true. They find when they sit alone, they get more concentrated. When they sit in a group, it's kind of complicated for them. Also, when you sit in a group, you kind of learn after a while, you're kind of similar to everybody else. There's a tendency for people who meditate alone a lot to suffer from certain delusions. For example, I'm the only one who doesn't know how to do this. I can't do it. It's so hard for me. I'm the only one whose meditation is difficult for. And when you go to a group, you realize other people have difficulty at times. Or the opposite extreme. I'm the one who's about to become a Buddha. And you're sitting there and you're so easy. It's so easy to be, it's really easy sometimes to be a Buddha. Feel like you're fully enlightened when you're sitting in your own bedroom and you're not having to relate to anybody. But then you see, you feel like you're more like similar to other people rather than some special case. If you live in a part of the country or situation where no one else meditates, it can be very lonely and very disheartening to feel like you're doing something that's different from everybody else. And especially if your values begin changing because of your meditation. And so to have other people to go to who are meditating, realize, you're not so weird. Your friends like, you're really weird. You do meditation? And they kind of kid you or tease you. And you feel like, well, you don't know if you want to continue because you stand out. When you come to a group, you realize you're kind of like not so weird after all. So those are some reasons I could think of.
So I've had both experiences. I started meditating and then I was reading Thich Nhat Hanh. And it's you must, meditate with the Sangha. So I seeked out this group and I went when you guys were in Palo Alto. And I did feel that fullness and kind of, palpable stillness. But then I've also felt distracted from the group.
So there's two things you could do. You can then not sit with us when it's not helpful, when you're distracted. Or the way the mindfulness way is, you take your distractibility as a subject of mindfulness. You're being distracted has something to do, says something about you. And so you might want to search out a lot of meditation groups so you can really get to the heart of how this distractibility works, how you're getting reactive, what happens when you're in a group, and use the meditation to really see that clearly until you become free of it. It's up to you. So we should stop. And then if you have more questions, you can ask afterwards. I'll stay here. And I want to thank you all for coming. It's been really lovely to have this group and meet with you. If you do come to other activities we do, everything that gets done here at the center is done on a donation basis, quite freely. You're welcome to contribute as you wish. For the intro class, we do have a suggested amount of donation. And that is that in the operations basket, which is for the center, we suggest $2 to $3 per class. And for the teacher basket, we suggest $10 per class per day each time we meet. But that's really up to you to decide what you want to do, because it's freely given in both directions. And So it's been lovely, and I appreciate it a lot. And I look forward to another chance to meet with you and take your questions. Some of you might want to come and do the intro class again, just to satisfy my desire to be able to be in further dialogue with all of you.
When will you run it again?
The next time will be in May. I think it starts, I believe it starts May 19th. It's the first time I'm going to do it on a Tuesday. So it's 5 weeks in May, I believe, starting in May, May 20th. And then, May 19th. And that's 5 weeks. And then I'll do it again in, I think, October. In October, it'll be 6 weeks. Thank you all.